This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Filmmaker John Waters is known for creating cinema that is, well, depraved. He shocked America in the early 70s with the underground hit Pink Flamingos, in which the main characters compete for the title of filthiest person alive. Then there's Polyester that allowed the audience to experience the film in Odorama using scratch and sniff cards.
People see those early movies and say, you all must have been on drugs when you made them. Well, we were. But the drugs you all take, I mean, ecstasy, a drug that makes you love everyone, that sounds like hell to me.
As John Waters talking about the films that made his career and solidified him as a celebrity of trash theater. But his success with movies like Hairspray and Crybaby also earned him a spot in the world of conventional film as well as a cult icon. And now he is revealing the depths of his depravity and the origins of his filmmaking career in a one-man show called This Filthy World, Filthier and Dirtier. Going to be performing tonight at 8 o'clock at the Carolina Theater in Durham. But first, he joins me on The State of Things. John Waters, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Well, good to have me here. I'm glad to be here.
You're glad that we're here, too. You grew up in Baltimore. Tell us how you got drawn to film.
Well, I always like telling people what to do. So that was, I was in show business when I was 12 years old. I had a successful career as a puppeteer for children's birthday parties. So I got Variety when I was 13. So I always had a career in show business. So I was lucky in the 60s, in the early 60s, underground film had first come out. And I read about it. And it said that, for the first time ever, you didn't need money. You didn't need Hollywood movie stars to make a movie. So I got a little Brownie camera that my grandmother gave me and made a movie. Just like today, kids make movies on their cell phone.
You attributed your work to negative influences that you had as a child. Who were your heroes?
Well, my heroes, I wrote a whole book about that called Role Models. Everybody from Johnny Mathis to Bobby Boris Pickett to Dagmar to usually the villains in Disney movies. That's what I always wanted to look like. And I think I've succeeded in life.
The Tingler played an important part in your movie career. Tell us about
yes,
that film.
And
remind
any
us
showmanship.
About that film. Yeah.
Yeah, well, William Castle had showmanship, basically. He had buzzers that went off under the seats in theaters, skeletons that came out. And when I saw House on Haunted Hill, the one that had the skeleton that came out on a wire from a box next to the screen, and it went over the audience of screaming children to the projection booth, I wanted to try and duplicate that later in my career. And the ending of Pink Flamingos got as close as I could ever get to that, where the whole audience went insane inside a theater, but for very different reasons, although maybe the same reasons, a kind of fear and horror.
Well, The Tingler, that was another film, again, which the theater itself played an important part. Certain seats wired so that they would tingle the viewer.
Buzzers went off.
Buzzers,
yeah,
right?
And
they got everybody.
I got recently for Christmas, someone gave me which really is hard to find, the actual manual of how they put that in the theater. And this would never happen today because each seat had three wires and each seat in each row had wires that were connected to other wires in the aisle that went up. I mean, it was really hard to do. But this was before video, before anything. So basically a movie would play in a movie theater for 6-8 weeks at a time on first run. So and only in one theater. So it could never happen today. That would never happen today.
Well, apparently before tort law as well, because you can imagine not being sued to death.
Really get a shock. What it was is a buzzer went off, under, like a hand buzzer the metal seat on the bottom. And I talked about William Castle so much, and I wrote about him in my books. I wrote the introduction to his autobiography when it was re-released. I've met his daughter. I met his wife before she died, and I know the family. So I've been a William Castle fan for a long time. And he was just a showman, such a showman that I kind of was a huge influence on what I did. The same reason I had Odorama in my movies and had different gimmicks and made insane movie stars and stuff. It was all because of William Castle and the nuns who read us the list of condemned movies every week. And, and I pretended I owned a dirty movie theater. And I would flip out the ads. Yeah.
the Legion of Decency.
Yeah. That was the first thing my mother told me. She knew I was going to rebel because I was 8 and we had to stand up in church and take that pledge, and I refused to. It was my first refusal.
Oh, that's great.
The Legion of Decency.
Legion of
and
Decency.
Still, The Catholic League attacked my last movie. I was so happy.
Well, I mean, this gets to what you do when you realize, as you said, that anybody can make a film. It turns out if you've got a brownie and you can develop your film, you can make a, quote, underground film. But then the question is, about what? You did choose kind of the shock factors. You wanted to make sure that all of your film had that.
Well, I wanted to surprise people. And underground movies were all about that. If you think about Warhol, and there were provocations, basically. The Kuchar brothers, Kenneth Anger. Everybody made underground movies. Part of that, the definition of an underground movie was to cause some kind of scandal or surprise people or to go to areas that regular Hollywood movies would never go to. Now, the problem is today they do go to those lengths, but they spend too much money.
Well, they do, and television as well. I mean, do you see a kind of genealogy? It's sort of interesting. If you watch, I think you watch programs like South Park or any of the reality shows. I mean, are you the grandfather of that kind of entertainment?
Well, I think one thing you said very different. I love South Park, and I think reality shows are the lowest there are because it asks you to be a classist and to feel superior to the people and laugh at them. So I think I do the opposite of that. I don't believe there is such a thing as a reality TV star. I think that's impossible. And they aren't even real anyway. So I think that's the lowest brow form of entertainment, actually.
That's interesting.
So to me, I made exploitation films for art theaters, really, is what I ended up doing. The most bad taste movies I made did the very best in the richest, classiest neighborhoods. They did not work in the grindhouse or the porn house because people that go see those movies that made Russ Meyer a hit and made Herschel Gordon Lewis a hit, they didn't think they were funny. They weren't hipsters laughing with them. They thought they were really sexy, and Russ Meyer movies were really sexy. Until they were passed by pornography becoming legal, which Russ never wanted to do. So those films were success without irony. And I think irony is the big difference. That's why their movies made way more than mine did.
Well, what about your training? Did you have any formal film training?
None. I just, a guy named Pete Gary at the Quality Film Labs in Baltimore was the person who taught me in the beginning. And the Teamster rejects that would illegally rent me their films from rent me their cameras from the TV stations. No, I learned from doing it. No school would have let me make those movies if I had gone there. Today they would. Today you can make a snuff movie and get an A at NYU.
Yeah. You exploited tragedy. You talked about exploitation films as well. Tragedies in American history. What impelled you to make those movies?
Well, what do you mean? Like I had the Kennedy assassination.
Well,
many people did the Kennedy assassination. I mean, certainly it's one of the most iconic images in the world. Warhol, everybody did it. The problem was that I reenacted it with Divine as Jackie, but it was 2 years after it happened, and people didn't think it was so funny. Maybe in 30 years you could have gotten away with it. Because it was such an iconic image that it needed to be satirized in a way because what happened with Jacqueline Kennedy, who I always loved, I thought she was great, but then the public turned on her when she married Aristotle Onassis because they wanted her to be this widow, this saint forever. So it was about American fame, and I think it was satirizing that a little early.
Interesting story, though. You were making that film. Divine plays the role of Jackie Kennedy Onassis. I guess some of the costume found its way into the trunk of your car. Your mother found it?
His mother. Divine's mother found it, the Jackie Kennedy outfit. And she didn't even know that Divine was Divine or we made movies or anything. And she said, what's this? And he was nervous. He didn't know what to say. He just said, I am Jackie Kennedy. And she changed the subject quickly.
Pink Flamingos. Was that the first hit for you, a cult classic, go back in the 60s?
Well, it depends what you mean by a hit. Multiple Maniacs cost, Mondo Trashel cost $2,500, and I got the money back, so that's a hit. Multiple Maniacs cost $5,000 each time I doubled it. And Pink Flamingos was the first one that got national distribution, yes, and it was a midnight hit, which meant it played two nights a week at midnight. Yes, it was a midnight hit, definitely, and it played forever and ever and ever. It played 10 years at least one day a week at the New Arts Cinema in Los Angeles.
No, amazing, and re-released in the 1990s. You say you're proud that you managed to offend three generations of moviegoers.
Well, it's four now. Oh. I said that quote when it was three. It's four now. Pink Flamingos still plays everywhere. Kids still find it. You know, they still discover it. It's played on television, something I never thought would possibly happen on the Sundance Channel. And the Directors Guild called me and said they want to cut two of the scenes in it. Is that all right? I said, oh, sure. And they forgot to, though. So I
wait, I'm only two scenes? I mean, you know, I'm very curious about which two scenes you cut.
The singing anus.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the chicken sex.
Yeah,
But the problem was they forgot to. And then I always tried to imagine a family on Thanksgiving or something, channel surfing, and getting to the singing anus. What's that? Just move on, next channel. Or maybe they stayed and watched it. I don't know. I never had any feedback negative. Nobody was up in arms about it. And it played a couple times.
No, but there's...
just, they all just played on Australian television. I mean, they do play. And the oddest thing, I got a financial statement recently with some money. I thought, what's this from? And it has detail. It was from Nicaraguan television for Pink Flamingos. Obviously, it's a hit on television there. Well, what do they say? This is what Americans are like. This is what capitalism will do to you. I don't know. But how could it be a hit there on television? Well, I think it's a bookkeeping mistake.
But the hit is the kind of the question I want to ask you, because I did see the film in the early 70s, so shortly after it was released, I guess. And it was at a screening on our campus in an auditorium. You know, we snuck in. I mean, everybody felt a little nervous about
it. You owe me money.
It was subversive. The check's in the mail. But it felt subversive. We felt like this was part of a movement that distinguished us from the rest of the universe. It was a subversive act just to be. Now it's on television. I mean, that's my question to you.
It didn't get nicer. It actually maybe got worse. The only thing that's dated in it is in the movie they steal children and sell them to lesbian couples. Well, now lesbians have more children than Catholics. So it's that's the only thing that dates it a little.
All right, let's talk about your book. Six of them you've written so far, one of which chronicles your hitchhiking adventure from Baltimore to San Francisco. Tell us about that trip.
Well, it was fun. I encourage you to do that this weekend. Take a hitchhiking trip. Especially, you know, a lot of people said, oh, I did it when I was young, but I did too, but I did it when I was 66. It's a big difference. And before I left, I imagined the best that could happen and the worst that could happen and wrote fiction. And then I did the real trip, which was 21 rides, 9 days. And I'm still amazed that I did it, if you want to know the truth. I thought, did I really do that? I walk out my front door and hitchhike to San Francisco from Baltimore. But I did. And I have very good memories of it. I'm still in touch with some of the people that picked me up. Many people didn't know who I was. They just thought I looked like a homeless old man when I'm standing there with a baseball cap and a sign, you know, and my little pitiful bag. So with my weather-beaten face. But all kinds of people gave me a ride. A cop, a trucker, a rock and roll band, a Republican elected official. But everybody was nice. I didn't have a scary ride. I'm not scared to hitchhike. I'm scared to stay home. Then nothing happens. And then a plane hits your house.
But you did talk about your fears when you talked about the best that could happen, the worst that could happen.
Oh, yeah. The worst that can happen, two things, diarrhea and getting murdered.
Well, those are bad.
Neither happened. But I did describe that in the fictional parts in much more detail than you probably want to know.
There's... The weird thing about that is Imodium will cure diarrhea, but there's no cure really for death. One of the fears is that you're going to end up with other sort of cult film directors, you know, with their...
being murdered. Yeah. That's what everybody, the worst thing that could happen is, and I wrote the best that could happen and the worst before I left. I could have never really imagined that if I had already done the trip. And I knew it was going to end the worst in my murder, and I did write that 2 days before I left. So I really wasn't scared of anything, really. I was scared. I stood there for 10 hours. I never expected that, how boring it would be. But I was never frightened of people. I'm not frightened of people in real life. I taught in prison, for God's sake. You know, I can get along with most all people.
We talked about some of these cult films, but then you made Hairspray in 1988, quite different from your earlier work. Were you thinking about creating more mainstream, working for a more mainstream audience?
No, it was an accident. You know, I think Hairspray is just like the only subversive movie I made, not Pink Flamingos, because it's playing in every high school in America is doing that now. And it's two men singing a love song to each other, and it's a comedy that encourages your white teenage daughter to date black guys. So, and no one seems to notice that. So if I did anything subversive, which is the nicest review you can get next to pernicious, I guess it was that movie, because Pink Flamingos is preaching to the converted. Let's put it that way. Nobody stumbles into Pink Flamingos and changes how they live their life.
That's true. You know what you're getting into.
Well, but
again, getting to the way things may or may not have changed over time. I mean, Is it harder and harder to create a film that'll have that effect on the effect? Of
I
the
never
film?
Tried to. Well, you mean as Pink Flamingos? Because yeah. Hairspray. The only thing that was shocking about it was that it was PG rated.
Well, not Hairspray, but Pink Flamingos. Again, I think it's harder.
I never
and harder.
Tried to top that. I never tried to. The only person, the person in spirit who is the most to those that period of my career, certainly Johnny Knoxville, who is a friend and starred in my last movie, A Dirty Shame. So Johnny Knoxville, I think, is the closest to the kind of humor that we always did. And if I had not done that ending of Pink Flamingos, Johnny Knoxville would have done it himself since.
You have, what are some of your favorite films?
Well, I write my 10 best list every year in art form, and they're usually depressing, long French movies. I hate a feel-good movie. I feel good anyway. I like to go in the theater and feel bad when I come out.
Yeah, so what are some of the films that do that for
you?
Oh,
this year, let me think. My favorite movie this year has just about to come out. It's called Map of the Stars, and David Cronenberg directed it, and it's written by Bruce Wagner. It's a feel-bad movie about Hollywood. Last year, I liked Harmony Korine's Spring Breakers, but I like all kinds of movies. I still see everything because I vote in the Oscars and the Directors Guild, the Writers Guild, the Spirit Awards, the SAG Awards. I even vote in the Razzies, the worst movies. So I'm really exhausted from watching all these movies too, because they're all due this week. So I've voted for everything. So I'm movied out this week.
Well, tell us about the stand-up act that you're touring with. What do we see? And how did you... Have you always done stand-up? This is kind of new
for
you.
Yeah, I've been doing it for 50 years. I do like 30, 40 of them a year. Yeah. I have a whole Christmas show that's different from This Filthy World that I did 20 of them last December. No, 17 of them in 20 days. So I've been doing it for a long time. Yeah, it's how I meet my fans. It's how I test material. I'm always updating it. That clip that you played was from This Filthy World a long time ago when it came out on Netflix. The show is almost completely different from that today, but that was a recorded version of the show.
Which do you like best? Do you like being on the road? Do you like filmmaking?
I like it all. I like writing books. I like telling stories. So I have many ways to do it. If one career isn't working, I go to the other. I like them all the same. They're all the same to me. Because I'm a writer. So I have to think up something every day, no matter which one of those careers it's in.
Got a film in the works?
I have a possible TV show in the work, but I never talk about things that are possible. That means in development. And it's like if you're trying to get pregnant, do you tell somebody? No.
Well, you might. But my question...
I think it's a bad idea.
It depends on who you're talking with, I suppose, at the moment. Did you...
I guess your partner.
You
maybe.
Want to tell
yeah.
them, right?
Oh, no. You better tell your partner.
Just to, you don't want
but
to...
But these days... How you get pregnant can be so many different ways. I mean, you can do it by yourself.
But what's interesting to you? So a TV show, I mean, what would be the kind of thing that would interest you in a TV show, even if it's not something?
Well, I can't tell you because it is what I'm doing. You know, a TV, though, is certainly these days, I think, better than independent movies. More people see it. They pay you more. It's just old people go to the movies now. You know, it's unfortunate. But yeah. When... I mean, the movies that I want to see, I'm not big on the... China has ruined everything for us because now all Hollywood makes movies that... Because there's 80 billion movie theaters right. in China. Now, all that China ever did for me, they used to pirate my movies and play Hairspray without paying me on television. And now they don't want Hairspray. They want a $100 million sci-fi movie with no stars, no subtitles, and just grunts and special effects. And... I'm saying that is what people like. People like those kind of movies. I never understand why people want to go to stadium seating, you know, unless Ben-Hur is playing. Then I get it. You get in the mood of it. But I'm sort of... I still like to go to the movies. I like the old movie theaters. I like the art theaters and everything. But I realize they are vanishing.
Well, John, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me on.
John Waters will be performing his one-man show, This Filthy World, tonight at the Carolina Theater in Durham. Just ahead, we explore the career of musical business legend Ralph Peer and music from Don Fleming. Stay tuned.